Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Thursday, March 26, 2009. And for your information, we're going to take the bills just a slight bit out of order and open up a work session on Senate Bill 377 first. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 377. We had public testimony on this bill quite a while ago and a work session just recently. And there is another amendment that is being drafted to Senate Bill 377, and we do not have that amendment back yet. So what I'm going to do is just let my committee members know that as soon as that amendment comes back, we decided to adopt that on this side rather than let it go over to the other chamber without that amendment. So as soon as that gets back, I will put it back up for what I hope will be the final work session. So now I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 377. The next two bills, Senate Bill 677 and 685, are bills of Senator Pozanski's, and we're waiting for him and expecting him any minute. And as soon as he gets here, we'll be doing those two bills, and then immediately following those, we will be doing Senate Bill 772 and Senate Bill 929 in that order. Thank you for your patience. Any update on Mary
Rose? I'm going to try that. Please. Thank you.
How come you're...
Bless you.
You're accommodating him when he's not here.
Well, good question.
I've explained the dash to...
Okay.
It's Harrison.
Mike's on.
Corrections of his all.
Okay. All on 315 and one little other thing?
Two things.
Okay. Two things on 315. Okay. So we're taking... Okay. Okay.
So we'll move okay?
Yeah, they're fine.
So when
I called him, I said, yesterday, I said, here's something you didn't do right. It says too late to fix those.
Right.
We'll decide whether we want to do something later. He fixed them all.
Okay, John. So what, when the chair asked me to summarize, I did a hand in
grasp. We're still on the record.
The microphone is
We're on the record.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. We're waiting for some. I'll wait another minute, maybe, and then I'll just have to go ahead.
If he comes in and
we're
on there, something else.
I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 772, and if Senator or when Senator Pozanski arrives, we'll close that briefly, do the other bills, and then go back to 772. So thank you for your patience. I'm going to ask our committee administrator to please summarize Senate Bill 772.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 772 has a variety of provisions related to manufactured dwelling park landlord and tenant relationships. It allows a landlord to convert certain utility and service billing method. It prescribes the procedures for that conversion. It allows the landlord to add additional amounts to billing of certain service or utility charges. It specifies limitations and procedures for the billing additions. It requires the landlord to make utility billing records from the preceding year available to the tenant. It specifies conditions and limitations for a pro rata billing method. It requires the Housing and Community Services Department to adopt rules and appoint an advisory committee to assist implementation of the registration and continuing education requirements. It requires an annual registration of a manufactured dwelling park landlord. It increases the maximum civil penalty for violation of registration or continuing education requirements from $500 to $1,000. It allows temporary occupancy agreements between the landlord and tenant and specifies the conditions, limitations, and contents of that temporary occupancy agreement. You have dash one amendments before you. There some of the provisions of the dash one amendments clarify the terms used in the measure and the amount of potential recovery by the tenant from the landlord if the landlord does not comply with the billing method conversion provisions. It replaces the temporary occupancy agreement section to clarify the procedures and language of that provision. It increases the time for payment of the civil penalty assessed for violation of registration and continuing education requirements from 30 to 90 days. You have a hand-engrossed version of the bill with the dash one amendments, and I just want to quickly, if you have that in front of you, run through Most of it will be self-explanatory with the carrots that you see in the insertions and redactions. But on page 2 of the printed bill, you'll see a note on the left-hand side that says see pages attached to page 2. So this is the printed hand-engrossed version. And you need to then jump to the following 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 pages of the Dash 1 amendment, which has to do with ORS. That whole section has to do with revisions to ORS 90.315. Then it sends you back to, again, the printed, original printed page 2, to section 5. And that language stays the same. You got to skip all of that stuff that Legislative Council put in as the Dash 1 revision to 315 to go to find then page 3 of the printed bill. Are you with me? So then you just keep going there. Then you go to page 5, and you'll see there's some insertions and redactions. Those are self-explanatory. 6, 7, 8, 9, and then on page 10 of the hand-engrossed version, so this is page 10 of the printed bill, original bill, you'll see temporary occupancy agreement and a big X on section 15. All of section 15 has been revised by Legislative Council, and that is contained right after page 11. You'll see there's three pages, I think, of that. Does that all make sense?
Terrific.
Nice. Okay.
Nice job, Lori. Thank you very much.
And then you go back to the original book. Thank you. I'm done.
Thank you. And we do have some Dash 2 amendments, too, that we received just prior to the hearing, and I'm sure the proponents of the bill will explain that. Now that Lori has done such a great job, and thorough job, explaining the bill and the amendments, I'm going to take a brief break and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 772 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 677.
All right, the thought was going to be 685.
Well, I'm going to do that. And Lori, could you please summarize Senate Bill 677?
Senate Bill 677, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It includes members of an employee's household in the exception or exemption from the application of the Residential Landlord and Tenant Act on the same terms that the employee of the landlord has that exception from the application of that act. And then it allows also the eviction of the members of an employee's household from the landlord's premises, on the same terms as that allowed of the employee of the landlord.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Przemski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. 677, Senate Bill 677, is a constituent bill. The attorney by the name of Dean Kaufman from the Eugene area brought this to my attention.
Oh, excuse me, Senator. It's been pointed out by some of my committee members that, for the record, could you please identify your name?
Oh, I apologize. I thought I had done so. But thank you for catching me on that.
You're welcome.
State Senator Floyd Przemski, District 4, which includes parts of Douglas and Lane counties. Senate Bill 677, as I said, comes from a constituent friend who is an attorney that deals with landlord-tenant issues as well as real estate matters. He brought to my attention where there was an individual who was employed as a caregiver for the owner of the residence, and for whatever reason, the caregiver's employment was terminated by the owner of the property. The caregiver had a live-in relationship with another individual that was also residing there where the caregiver was living at the house owned by the, call him the employer of the caregiver. When the caregiver lost his position and was told to leave, the person that he was in a relationship said that they had the ability to stay there because there was a relationship that had been, let's call it unintentionally created between the caregiver, the owner and the third party. And so the courts apparently have ruled and basically came down on the same perspective that there was a requirement that would need to be followed by the owner. And, of course, the owner that was receiving care from the caregiver never intended to extend any type of landlord-tenant relationship to this third-party individual. And so what they found themselves is that they were not able to remove that individual without going through a more detailed process. So the purpose of the bill is to attempt to address that. It turns out, and Mr. John Van Lanningham is here, who is another very qualified individual in this area. who also knows Mr. Kaufman, and they had some discussions, and Mr. Van Lanningham brought it to Mr. Kaufman's attention that what he was attempting to do couldn't be done under the statutes that were cited in the bill. And so basically we now have a bill that is not does not have a relating clause that can be modified. And so what we're doing at this point is looking for other bills that might be a vehicle to address those issues. My understanding in speaking with Mr. Van Lanningham, that he was sympathetic to the issue that Mr. Kaufman is attempting to resolve, and that he has suggested some different areas within the existing statutes where that could be performed, but we need to find the appropriate vehicle for that. So at this point, there's not a need for this bill for, from the carrier's perspective as to the sponsor of the bill to move it forward at this time.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any questions? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 677, and if you do find another bill, we'll do what we can if it comes to this committee to accommodate that.
Thank you.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 685 and ask Lori to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 685, Madam Chair, members of the committee, prohibits the creditor from denying credit to an applicant solely because the applicant used a business address instead of a residential address if state law or local ordinance permits the use of a business address on that application for credit.
Thank you. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Senator Hoyt. I'm still representing District 4, parts of Lane and Douglas counties. The purpose for Senate Bill 685 is actually to allow individuals specifically in law enforcement or those who have been received some type of exemption from using their home address for reporting purposes, district attorney's offices, their district attorneys, city attorneys, etc., who are permitted to use a business address to actually use that in an application for a line of credit through some an association or some type of a creditor. The purpose for that is so that their individual residential address, which is protected under state law, can maintain its confidentiality and not be subject to being found. As you can imagine, the reason that we in the state of Oregon, as many other states have done, we have decided that certain individuals, because of the line of work they're in, because of the potential threat to themselves and their family, that we have agreed to honor their need to have their resident address kept confidential. So that's the purpose of the bill, and I've had a very short conversation with Mr. Martinez. I believe he's not going to come forward unless the committee asks him to. There is apparently some issues as to whether or not this would, in fact, be, let's say, applicable to organizations that are outside of the state that may be making available credit for people within the state. And that's one of those issues I guess we can always look at in the future as to what would be the application for creditors outside of the state versus those within the state. But it's something that I believe that in trying to make certain those individuals that have the right to use a business address versus their residential address should have that opportunity.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici. I'd like to compliment you on the bill. I am a person that doesn't use my home address because I live out in the country. Identity theft is a big problem out where I am, and especially meth. So I use my business address. So I fully understand the need for the bill.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I do want to just put on the record, just for not that I'm going to be voting on it at this point, but I do want to give full disclosure. In my day job, outside of being a senator, I do serve as a prosecutor in the municipal courts in Lane County, and have had, so I would actually be affected by this bill as well. And I do as Senator Gerard does, as to trying to maintain confidentiality of my residential address.
Thank you, Senator. Senator George?
Senator, I know, just because I don't know the statute, so when a person is a public employee, when you say business address, is that defined as a P.O. box that they may have, or is it actually their address where they go, like in your situation, courthouse or whatever?
Yeah. Most cases what you see is, and I'll use the example of law enforcement, whatever the official address is for the law enforcement agency is the one that's reported, such as for Eugene Police Department, it would be 777 Pearl Street, Eugene, Oregon. Florence, Oregon, that would be 900 Greenwood Street, Florence, which are the headquarters, the locations of the departments.
So, Madam Chair, follow up. So physical addresses are always required, or can you use P.O. boxes in that? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is does the term business address also, is it broad enough to include P.O. boxes?
I will say that some individuals do, in fact, use P.O. boxes.
And that's fine.
As far as I'm concerned, it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Martinez, is there anything you'd like to say?
Okay.
Is there anyone else who signed up to testify on Senate Bill 685? We are not able to do a work session on this bill because we don't have the fiscal statement. We have notice of no revenue, but we don't have notice of no fiscal impact. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 685. And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. I'll return to my other committee.
I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 772.
And thank you for taking
I'm
out
going to put her over bottom.
And I won't ask Lori to, again, I do have the list. And first I'm going to ask John Van Landingham and Pat Schwab. Take them up. Thanks. Schwab.
Chair. Because what I have to say is not very much.
Good afternoon,
welcome.
Senator Bonamici and your helpers. My name is Pat Schwab. I represent Manufactured Homeowners of Oregon. Okay. I have a very brief statement that I'd like to make. I believe this is the ninth session that I've testified in a committee in the Capitol. And this all began back in 95 when we were protesting the fact that the landlords were looking for benefits that we had not had any relationship with. And we showed up in a group where then Senator Kennemer was, and he said to the landlords, I don't want you people to ever show up in here again unless you've worked with the residents and everybody is in agreement. And so that's where we've been, and we're now at this point, and this is our seventh year that we've negotiated legislation. So that's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. John?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center. I am the facilitator of the Manufactured Housing Landlord Tenant Coalition, which is the sponsor of, or the requester of this bill through Senator Bonamici. The bill was negotiated and drafted in 10 meetings, typically of 3 hours each, from last September to February. There's a separate coalition that does general apartment landlord tenant law that you did Senate Bill 771. You heard that last Thursday, a week ago. And as Pat noted, this coalition has existed since 95. It's produced a negotiated bill every session since then. Just point out for you that manufactured housing park tenants and marina, floating home marina residents have more rights than apartment tenants. There are amendments. Lori went through the dash one. I can tell you, I won't try to explain to you why they're dash two, but I can tell you what the dash two does. Not a whole lot. If you look at Lori's hand engrossed bill on page two of that, on line 29 and 30, LC corrected an error that LC made in the dash ones, and actually that Lori missed as well. It should read, that line 29 to 30 should read, for cable television, direct satellite, or other video subscription services, or for internet access or usage as provided under subsection 1 of this section. So a very minor issue. And then the dash 2 makes one other change on page, it's 5 as you count them, 3 of the insert. In other words, page 3 of the dash 1 amendments. At the bottom of that page, we're amending here existing statute 90.315, sub C. Sub C at the bottom of that page will be replaced in the dash 2 by the same language that's in Senate Bill 772, section 3, sub 2. This occurs because there are two statutes that do the same thing. One in the general statutes for apartments and one in the manufactured housing park statutes. LC didn't realize initially that they needed to be the same, so LC is trying to get them to be the same. So there's not a substantive issue there. The bill, as Lori described, the bill, I break the bill down into doing four things, and I'm not going to talk about them in any great detail unless you ask questions. I've given you some written testimony that does that. It's a four-page handout. I'll do them in reverse order because that's the reverse order of complexity. The simplest issue is to expand the ability of residents to put political signs on the space, not just on the home. Since they rent the space for their home, the current statute says they can put up a political sign on the home, but not on the space. This would let them take control of their space, which is how they expect things to be. The second issue is something called a temporary occupant agreement. I described that to you last week in Senate Bill 771. Same language, same issue, no changes. The third issue is enforcement of mandatory landlord registration and education. It's an important issue to both parties. Apartment landlords are not required to register. Manufactured housing park and marina facility landlords are required to register. This bill would amend that registration requirement to make it be annual for all parks, only for parks, not for marinas. And I can explain why if you're curious. And they, with that registration, they would pay a $25 annual registration fee. That fee would then support the Housing and Community Services Department's Manufactured Communities Resource Center, formerly known as the Ombudsman, before we got that changed, and would fund their efforts to make sure that all park landlords actually do register and do the required education. So that's an important thing. There's some more stuff in there, but I think that's the main points to make. The fourth and most important issue in the bill is submetering. It has to do with how utilities are charged by landlords of residents. Your other bill today, Senate Bill 929, relates to submetering also. And I'm going to stop there unless the chair tells me to start talking about submetering because it's complicated.
Well, if you could explain, John, please, what 772 does with regard to submetering and utilities, it would be helpful.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici. So the current law has always allowed landlords to pass through in some form or another the utility charges that they pay for the residents. In 2005, the coalition bill, which also was the bill that required registration and education, also changed the law about submetering and passing through utility costs. And what we did there was to codify the three ways that landlords recover utility costs from residents that the landlord pays for the park. There's a fourth way that doesn't usually occur except for electricity, where the electric utility bills the tenant directly. So the landlord's not part of the deal. But in the other deals, for example, with water, there's a master meter on the park. The landlord pays the utility bill to the utility company and then bills the tenants in some form. And that can be done, recovered in one of three ways. In the rent, as part of the rent, as with any operating cost of a landlord. Secondly, by something that we are now calling the pro rata method, in which the landlord divides the bill up among the park residents, and the current law allows the landlord to do it in one of two ways: square footage, which nobody does because it's too complicated, or per space. So if there's 10 spaces, the landlord divides the park into 10 units, and if the bill is $100, I can actually do that math, so that would be $10 per space. So that is the primary pro rata method of recovery per space. The third method is submetering. All of us, I think I can say, all of us on all sides of this issue would like to have, especially water, submetered. Water used to be recovered by landlords in the rent because water didn't cost much. As you can imagine, water now costs a lot, especially because it's now tied to sewer. And many utilities bill bill your sewer charge based on how much water you consume. So landlords have been eager to get out of paying for that. They could recover it in the rent, but rent increases are a bit cumbersome. They make tenants mad. Tenants never see them go down. So landlords have been eager to change the water recovery method from in the rent to something else. Tenants, and we are tenant advocates, or we think of ourselves that way, would like to see water recovered by submeter. Submeter would be an actual meter on the utility line at the space. So if Pat is renting space 20, she would only pay for water that came into space 20. Sort of. And I'll talk more about the sort of later. But at least that says that Pat and her husband Fred would only pay for the water that she's using on her space, as opposed to her neighbor who has five teenagers who take very long showers every day. In a per space basis, and I had a daughter that did that, in a per space basis, they're each going to pay the same, even though the five teenagers are using a lot of water and Pat's not using a lot of water. So the per space basis creates hard feelings among tenants, and it also discourages conservation. So you're going to pay the same no matter how much you use, so why bother conserving? So in 2005, we allowed landlords to unilaterally amend the rental agreements to switch to submeters. That's a significant thing. In park tenancies, landlords can't change the rental agreement unilaterally. In apartment tenancies, they can, sort of. They can do that. But and I know Senator George is a landlord, so he can change his rules. But if he owned a park, he could not, except for this. And so we're trying to encourage that submetering issue. There are some problems with submetering, and I think you'll hear some testimony from landlords later about issues they have getting to submetering. There's a problem that we've had with the PUC that will be fixed by a bill from Representative Buckley, 2613, that we've worked on to make work. But there also have been some problems in the implementation of that bill. Some residents feel that some landlords have taken advantage of that bill. So a number of the changes here are meant to tighten up submetering of water. And one way that we're doing that is we're saying that it now appears to us that pro rata, per space billing for water is not working. And so we are in the bill prohibiting that going forward to the future. But we are allowing it on a per occupant basis. So if a landlord wants to take the number of occupants, and to make it easier for my math, there are 100 occupants in the park in 10 spaces, but we know how many are in each space, then on a per occupant basis you could divvy that up. So Pat would have two 100s for herself and her husband. And that there's a correlation there between the number of occupants and the consumption, the amount of water typically consumed. Not exactly, but sort of. Texas, by the way, which regulates utilities much more severely than Oregon does, by rule, by state agency, prohibits the per-space method of charging for water in a pro-rata method, but does allow the per-occupant method. So we're prohibiting going forward the per-space method, allowing the per-occupant method. You may hear testimony that people would like that to be prohibited for all now, and if you think constitutionally you can do that, be fine by me, but I don't think it would be fine by some landlords. The bill makes a number of other changes, but I think those are the ones that I wanted to mention.
Thank you. Are there questions? Any questions? Senator Dredd.
Well, thank you, Chair. I'd just like to compliment you on your working group, and I was really impressed with the fact that you stood by your agreement in 2007, and that pays dividends with me.
Thank you. I failed to mention that MHCO supports the bill. I think other landlords do. I've listed the members of the coalition, or described the number of members of the coalition. There are a lot of people that are on the email list, including Senator Bonamici, who don't necessarily support the bill. But there are about 18 active members, and I think they support the bill.
John, is there anything in Senate Bill 772 that would prohibit a landlord from submetering now?
Madam Chair, no. But maybe I should save this for 929. I'll save that for. I'll save some comments for 929.
Okay.
No, they would not.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And next, I have Steve Terwalt and Charlie Graff, please. Welcome. And if you could state your name for the record, please, and if you could keep your testimony to 772, and then we'll do 929 separately.
Thank you. For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Charlie Greff, G-R-E-E-F. And I'm here with Steve Terrell.
My name is Steve Terrell, T-E-R-R-E-A-U-L-T.
Thank you. Who's going first?
I guess I'll go first, Madam Chair. Thank you, and I appreciate the time taken here today. I'm Charlie Greff. I'm an attorney in Lake Oswego. I've been practicing law since 1989, represent numerous manufactured dwelling park facilities throughout the state. I've been a part of the Landlord-Tenant Legislative Coalition since approximately 1997. I'm here today on behalf of a group called the Oregon Park Owners Alliance, or the OPOA. They are a group which supports landlord and park owner rights in the coalition, and they've been active since 2001. Let me begin by giving you my substantive comments behind SB 772. This was the product of the Manufactured Dwelling Park Coalition, which met, discussed, opined about, and engaged in extensive negotiation over the terms and conditions set forth in the bill. Many park owners spent thousands of dollars of their own money to travel from remote locations to be present and participate in the meetings. I'd like to make mention of Paul Brewer, who cannot be here today, but has been really heroic in his efforts in the coalition. I also want to thank all of my fellow coalition members, especially John Van Landingham, for tireless hours spent in the meetings, behind the computer, and working late into the night to make this bill come about. The three components of 772, I won't reiterate everything John said, but the first one about the park owner's ability to bill for utility services specifically addresses many concerns which I believe were raised by Senator Bonamici to the group. We worked long hours to address all of her concerns as to submetering, and we did so through a process of good faith negotiation. The second component modifies the law relating to mandatory education of park managers, along with giving the Housing and Community Services Department greater ability to enforce education laws. The final piece relates to temporary occupants who seek to live in manufactured dwelling park facilities, and was a well-needed change to the law given the ambiguous current legal status of someone who seeks to temporarily live in a park. Someone who's neither a guest, which is defined under park rules usually up to 14 or 30 days in a year, nor a full-blown tenant who goes through a rigorous screening process and has to sign a rental agreement. So this benefits everybody, because often you have caretakers who need to live and help existing tenants but don't want the full responsibility of a tenant. In summary, I believe this bill is the product of give-and-take, back-and-forth negotiation. Ultimately, all coalition members received something which they wanted in exchange for giving up some of their rights. It is a good bill. I think, like any other coalition negotiated bill, nobody walked away with everything that they wanted, but nobody felt that they were blindsided. So I would ask that you forward this with a due pass recommendation, and I will be testifying on the other bill when it comes up. Thank you.
And just a question, do you support the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments as well?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Mr. Terrell?
Again, my name is Steve Terrell, Madam Chair, committee members. I am the regional manager for Cal-Am Properties. Cal-Am owns and or operates 8 manufactured home communities in Oregon and 3 in Washington State. I'm here today to testify in favor of SB 772. I had the pleasure of working briefly on the coalition committee that worked many long hours to produce a bill that, while imperfect, will significantly improve such vexing issues as mandatory education for community managers, submetering water and sewer usage, and temporary occupancy provisions contained in the current statutes. As a regional manager with a global perspective, I'm confident that this bill is a fair bill that Cal-Am supports and will eagerly endorse.
Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator George.
My concern, I guess, is that I'm always worried about smaller park owners, somebody at the coast who has a small little park. And I notice a civil penalty for noncompliance goes from $500 to $1,000. And for large park owners, I'm guessing that's a pretty insignificant fee. But what we're doing is putting some additional registration fees, extensive, continuing education, and then all of a sudden, some park owners who are local folks who own one little park get slapped with a $1,000 fee because they don't comply. And I'm just asking, why is that fee going up so significantly?
Well, and I agree with you. I represent a number of the mom-and-pop smaller parks. They make up a big portion of my client base. And I was concerned as well when this came up for discussion. But what I also understand is that we're going to have administrative rules that are going to be implemented relating to how they get up to this $1,000. For, you know, a first-time offense, if someone just fails to complete the registration, there probably will be no fine at all. The big issue that came up in the coalition was, if I make a technical slip-up and don't send in my registration, am I going to be dinged with this big fine? And the answer is, no, you're not. My understanding is that there is going to be a group of folks, I think they refer to it as a stakeholder group, who's going to work with the department to work up these administrative rules that'll show basically this kind of grade uptick, if you will, up to the $1,000 max for the absolute worst offenders. I mean, this is something that's been around since 2005. There are quite a few park owners, unfortunately, around the state who just haven't gone through either the registration or the education process, and you know, you get to the point where we have to do something to get people to go along with what the law requires. So appreciate your concern.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? I wanted to ask, there's something in Section 4 of the bill that states that the landlord shall, upon written request by the tenant, make available for inspection by the tenant all utility billing records relating to a utility or service charge billed to the tenant. Is that a change from current procedure or practice?
Well, as far as my folks are concerned, and I think I can speak for Steve Turow, it's not a change. We've always been transparent in terms of the way we do business and making that information available.
It's not currently in the law, as far as I know. I believe it's not currently in the law. I haven't seen it there. However, we have, when we implemented this at our properties, we voluntarily produce this information on a monthly basis so people have it for their records.
If I might, Madam Chair, I believe that there was a temporal limit as to how far back in time those records would go. I don't know if that's changed as a result of any of the amendments or not, but that was something we did discuss in terms of how far back in time those records would go.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for
Thank
your testimony.
You.
Next, I have Kathy Cruz. Welcome. And if you'll start by stating your name for the record, please, and if you could confine your comments to Senate Bill 772, and then we'll move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kathy Cruz. I'm a resident of Heritage Village Mobile Home Park in Beaverton. I come before you today to speak against Senate Bill 772 on behalf of the 400 occupied households in my community. Heritage Village has a total number of 450 spaces, of which 33 are empty, meaning that there are no homes on these lots. Approximately 25 are unoccupied, and 22 have for sale signs in their windows. There are other homes that are for sale by the park owner, Calam, but do not have for sale signs. We have an extremely low occupancy rate due to homeowners' inability to afford rising costs. Our current space rent is $587 per month. And our water and sewer bill is scheduled to go up to approximately $90 per household per month on April 1st. First, I would like to point out that we are not against certain provisions of the bill, such as prorating costs for digital cable services. That could actually result in savings for residents and providing a statement of policy for homeowners. That wasn't done for me when I moved in. Ultimately, it was done last year after 4 years of waiting for it. What it boils down for us at Heritage Village is what I refer to as the M&Ms of mobile home living. M&Ms as in money and maintenance. These are the important issues, and Senate Bill 772 does not address these. I will talk about maintenance first, and I reference page 7, line 39, subsection enforcement, registration, and education.
And Kathy, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize your testimony because we need to have time to get to the other bill. So
okay.
We will read all this, but if you could summarize and tell us what's in each of the sections in your testimony, we'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. I'll skip over some that I would have read. We have excellent managers at Heritage Village. I want to make that point very clear. In fact, we live in fear of losing them each and every day. no amount of education in the form of the requirements outlined in 772, 6 hours of continuing education every 2 years, are going to help them in their plight. Their problem, as we see it, is that we've gone from a maintenance staff of 12 people down to one-third of that size. We used to have a security guard at the park entrance. We have no more security. Because of our vacancy rate, our dwindled maintenance staff spends all of their time, almost all of their time, refurbishing homes that have been walked away from by homeowners so that they can be sold. These are homes that then become the owner's property and then are refurbished and sold. In spite of the efforts of our managers, and they are, I believe, the best in the industry, we are still suffering under tremendous consequences of lack of maintenance in our community. I have files and files of photographs that illustrate this, and I welcome any of you to walk the park with me. Today, it's as bad as it was last year. Let me skip over that to shorten this up for us. I'm just going to speak very briefly about the temporary occupant agreement, which is on page 10, line 14. This part is irrelevant as far as we're concerned. It's impossible. We've been told that it's impossible to determine the number of residents within our community due to federal fair housing laws, discriminatory against families, perhaps. We don't know who comes and goes. People come and go all the time. People move out, move in, no for sale signs. Relatives, families bundle together and live multiple families to a home. We don't even know how many people are there. How can we tell who's a guest? So temporary occupancy permit is irrelevant. The final issue that I would like to talk about is submetering. Begins on page 1, line 7. This section is the real meat of the bill, but it effectively maintains the status quo for homeowners because it does not mandate submetering of water and sewer. And Senator Bonamici, you asked the question, is there anything to prevent a park owner from submetering immediately? And John Van Landingham answered you by saying, no, there is not. My point is that there is nothing either to compel a park owner to submeter. And this bill, bottom line, is that it does not compel submetering. Submetering is, in our opinion, the only fair way to apportion utility costs across the population and also to surface flaws in the system, inefficiencies, leaks. We are currently paying nearly double that for the rest of the Tualatin Valley Water District. We have smaller homes, smaller yards. Our bills are double for single-family homes in our district. There's a reason for that. We have an older, deteriorated system, which we know is inefficient. That is a huge understatement. Let me try to skip further. In talking about prorating charges, I call your attention to page 6, line 37. Describing the means for prorating the charges. Basically, there are three ways. Number of occupied spaces, which is what we are under at Heritage Village. Number of occupants in the dwelling. It's not possible to determine the number of occupants in a dwelling. We can't conduct a census. A census cannot be conducted, or so we've been told. And because of the flux in and out, which happens with no one's knowledge, there's no possibility of conducting a census. And there's no possible way to determine whether there is a correlation without submetering. You cannot determine whether there's a correlation between number of occupants per home and water usage or square footage and water uses. We have plenty of homes that are some of the older homes in the park. They are large and lovely that are occupied by one elderly person where the water consumption is very low. And then we have other homes with smaller square footage where the consumption is very high. So that's the point that I would like to make about that. We at Heritage Village are living proof that pro rata methods do not work, and we assert that the only equitable way of apportioning these costs is through submetering. Submetering would not only allow residents to pay only for water that they actually use, but would provide a means of quickly discovering where wastage in the system is occurring. Submetering would also promote conservation. People would have incentives to fix leaks. If your bill was high and you had a leak, you'd have an incentive to fix it, and most of the fixes are very inexpensive. They're affordable. And it also would provide an incentive for the park owner to fix leaks within the system, to make the system more efficient. Some of those opposed submetering have said, we can't possibly require all park owners in the state to submeter. And I think I would agree with that, because it would be a burden on smaller landlords. So don't require it of them. Make it such that large park owners of large parks would need to submeter, because that's where we have the problems. The out-of-state large corporations are where we are facing the problems.
And Kathy, I see that the rest of your testimony is about Senate Bill 929, so...
There's one other point that is not about 929, and I'll make it very briefly. It actually is a closing statement. I'd like to assert that legislation by coalition does not work. We understand the rationale and history that has brought us to the reality of legislation by coalition. But I am here to say that the rationale does not justify the means. The requirement for coalition consensus makes it impossible for the M&Ms, money and maintenance, of homeowners to be taken seriously. Makes it impossible for OSTA to effectively represent the rights and needs of its paying constituents. And in fact, OSTA's constituents object to OSTA's support of SB 772, but are strongly supportive of Senate Bill 929. It also makes it impossible for good-hearted, hard-working people like John Van Landingham to make a significant positive impact. Yes, there are small crumbs here and there which benefit homeowners, but when it comes to the major issues which affect quality of life and affordability in mobile home parks, homeowners are always shorted. Senator Bonamici, we, your constituents, are most grateful that you have been such a driving force in crafting the other bill. I won't mention it. We consider that legislation to be nothing short of courageous, and I honestly mean that, because that's taking a real step forward. I therefore implore you to support that legislation, which is the only bill which begins to make headway for homeowners. Senate Bill 929 does address the M&Ms that truly matter. Thank you all very much for your time.
Kathy, thank you. Don't leave yet. There might be some questions.
Okay.
Are there any questions for Kathy? Any questions? No. Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify about Senate Bill 772? And I just want to get clarification. It's my understanding that the Dash 2 amendments completely replace the Dash 1 amendments. Is that correct, Lori?
That is. Okay. We've talked to proponents, and they've reviewed the amendments, and they have let us know that the Dash 2s are a complete replacement.
And this isn't typical, but I'm going to ask John to come back up, because some questions have been raised that we'd like to address to John.
John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid.
John, thank you very much for coming back up. It always concerns me when we have people raise the federal fair housing laws. The question was that they can't conduct a census because it would violate the fair housing laws. Do you agree with that?
Madam Chair, Senator George, no. And we've discussed it at great length within the coalition. I'm a lawyer. I've done this for 30 years. I'm on the board of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, which is funded through HUD to do fair housing enforcement. I have talked to Peggy McGuire, who was the longtime director of the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, and one of our other board members, who was the former enforcement person from HUD in Seattle. I could keep going. But a number of us in the coalition have discussed that. I understand that CalAM's lawyer, Charlie Greff, who testified before you earlier, disagrees with me. That's the nature of lawyers, isn't it? But I am convinced that it is not a fair housing violation for a landlord to charge utilities based on number of occupants, where there's a correlation between the number of occupants and the consumption. So if it were cable TV with one TV and 47 people watching it, no. Water, 47 people, yes, they use more water than one person.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Go ahead. Hey,
John, if we pass this legislation and somebody does challenge that, and that is struck as a violation of the federal Federal Fair Housing Act, what would happen to this legislation, or what would happen to the statute?
Madam Chair, Senator George, the statute's there unless you take it away.
Right.
And so if that were to happen, then it would be bad in the sense that it would guide landlords and suggest they could do something that the federal law disagrees with. I would remind you that fair housing law now in Oregon is enforced through BOLI,
okay.
which a number of us supported strongly 2 years ago to get BOLI to be substantial equivalent so it could do the enforcement. So it would be enforced at the local level.
Thank you.
And again, I remind you that Texas, which is not necessarily a liberal state, takes the same view that per occupant charge is legal, per space is not allowed.
And just a clarification, because I have done quite a lot of looking into this. This is not legal advice, because unlike John, I'm not an active member of the bar. But I also talked to BOLI, and BOLI confirmed what John said, that it's appropriate as long as there's a reasonable basis. If it's only being done for a discriminatory basis, then it would be inappropriate. But because there's a reasonable basis, a justifiable reason, it is not a violation of Federal Fair Housing Act. It's also very common in apartment buildings to use something called, the acronym is RUBS, Ratio Unit Billing System, and that's where the apartment landlord will factor in things like number of occupants, square footage, and then come up. There are actually RUBS companies that actually do the calculation and figure out what's a fair allocation. So it is very typical in ratio billing in apartment buildings, and I've been assured by the people who do Federal Fair Housing cases at BOLI that this is not a problem.
Great. Thank you very much.
If I could add one other thing, other question.
You'll identify yourself for the record.
John Van Landingham. Senator George asked about the $1,000 penalty. We discussed that at great length in the coalition also. I actually wanted a $5,000 maximum penalty, and that's where we were until the last minute when the landlords negotiated it down. So we tried to be sensitive to that concern.
Thank you, John. Any other questions? Okay. We are not able to move this bill today because we don't have the fiscal impact statement. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 772, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 929 and ask Lori to please give us a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 929 requires manufactured dwelling park landlords to use submetering as the billing method when the landlord assesses the tenant utility or service charges for water. And it requires compliance. You'll see on the bill as introduced, the date is missing, and the -1 amendment that you should have inserts 2012, so it would be January 2nd, 2012, as the date for required compliance.
Thank you very much. And first I'm going to call Peter Ferris, and is there somebody you wanted to bring with you? Did you set up a panel?
We'd like to have, Larry Alexander.
Okay, Peter Ferris and Larry Alexander, please. Is Larry here?
Yeah. He's
terrific.
Right.
And if you'll please state your name for the record, please. Thank you.
My name is Peter Ferris. I'm the executive director and lobbyist for the Oregon Manufactured Homeowners United, and I live at a mobile home park in Walport.
My name is Larry Alexander. I'm the manager of the Boring Water District in Boring, Oregon. I live in a mobile home park in Clackamas County.
Thank you. Peter, you want to go first?
Surely. Thank you very much, Senator Bonamici and the rest of the committee. I want to frame this business about the coalition first. It'll be very short. Our organization takes a fundamental different view of the coalition. As a labor organizer for many years, I realized that if a one party owns the statutes, which I firmly believe is the case with the landlords, and by that owns the statutes, I mean that they can raise rents whenever they want, whenever, given a 90-day notice, as much as they want. And there are very few penalties in Title 10, Chapter 9, Chapter 90, that actually actually would enable a resident to lawyer up, and the lawyer would actually be able to then pay part of his salary in doing so. In other words, we're at a loss for lawyering up because we know that Cal-Am and Brian Fitterer and some of the big parks have deep pockets. So we have made this political decision to work in grassroots organizing throughout the state because we think that's the way in which we can level this playing field. So that's a fundamental difference, and we started this difference back in last session, and it's been somewhat contentious, but we're trying to work through it. So now, the reason why I'm here today to favor 929, because I think submetering is the best way to go about it. And what I would like to do is to talk about some ideas I have about the bill, because I think the bill, both bills, one does too little and one does too much. So I believe in Aikido here. I'd like to see a bill that would mandate submetering for some park owners. And I think, Senator George, your comment is appropriate about when you asked John Van Landingham about local control and small mom and pop landlords. I mean, a lot of people think I hate landlords. Well, I don't hate landlords. What I hate is certain landlords who are what I call rogue landlords, and I would put Cal-Am in that category. So, but the thing, let's get back to the Aikido.
Yeah, and Peter, if you could keep your comments to the bill, we have a lot more witnesses.
I know. I'm going to give you three zingers here, and then I'll be through. What I would suggest is the way we could work 929 is to first of all license all park owners in the state. Number two, we would then allow individual residents, because they know best where there's a problem with water in their park, if there is. Then we can empower DEQ to find out if that's the case, because it might not be the case. And that will, and so I think that will then focus on the parks that are the real problems. A lot of the older parks are not real problems. It all depends upon maintenance. And I think Kathy Cruz made that point. So many of the large corporate park owners from out of state don't believe in maintenance. They don't. And so it's bare bones maintenance. So for that reason, I think we have a real opportunity here to level this playing field and do the right thing, which is submetering, because it's beneficial to the park owners also. What's happening in Heritage Village is, to my way of thinking, is that the park owner is shooting himself in the foot. He's losing a lot of income every month by the fact that people are self-evicting themselves from the park. So that's all I need to say. Thank you.
And we'll listen to the rest of the panel and then take questions. Mr. Alexander, please.
Thank you, madam. I came before you today to speak about the water metering issue. I'm currently employed as a manager of the Boring Water District, and I hold a Level 2 distribution license. I have taken many courses on water management and conservation. Many of these courses were through the Oregon Water Resource Division as well as the State Drinking Water Program. The classes are required to take are going to maintain our licensing requirements. I have also attended numerous water education classes through the Oregon Association of Water Utilities and Special Districts of Oregon. As manager of the Boring Water District for the past 9 years, I have had on-hand experience as to why metering is very important for both safety and water conservation. I have over 20 years of construction experience in building water systems as well as building mobile home parks. For the past 34 years, I have resided in a mobile home park and have experienced how the Fitterer Company has operated a water system. The Oregon Water Resource Division is a leading agency on water conservation. They require that we meter all our water into our systems and out to the customer. And the purpose of this requirement is to monitor the water and determine the water loss. We are required not to have over a 10% water loss in our system. Mobile home parks at this time are not required to monitor their sources or report their losses. Many of these systems, in fact, are experiencing large amounts of water losses. Water is a very heavily used natural resource, and it's the state of Oregon's job, as well as all the water systems, to help guard this resource from overuse in the form of waste. Every system, no matter how large or small, has a role to play in guarding this resource. Even the end user can be notified if their water use is extremely high. If their water meter records a higher than normal reading, I have instances where a leaking toilet has in fact doubled a resident's water usage. When the homeowner gets the water bill, they scream like crazy. But if they don't have a water meter, no one cares about the waste. With the water being metered into and out of every system, you can control your water loss. You immediately start looking at your system to find where the leaks may be coming from. They make devices that allow the operator to listen for water leaks, and there are companies that specialize in leak detection for large and small systems. However, if you don't meter, you have no idea how much water you may be wasting. Another issue is the added cost to the system. If you buy water, you're paying for more water than you need to be. So what do the owners of mobile home parks do? They raise the rent rather than find the leaks and repair them. Also, if you are on wells, the leaks cause higher electric bills as well as higher maintenance for the cost of the pumps. Another issue is what I call water safety. Water safety, when systems have leaks and the system pressure drops below 20 pounds, you can have a reverse water issue. This is when the groundwater can get into the water system and contaminate the water supply to the residents. When the water system is shut down for repair, and there are leaks in the system, you have what is called a negative pressure. And this system actually sucks groundwater into the pipes. If the system isn't adequately flushed after one of these events or lower negative pressure, the dirty water is contaminated, is water ends up in the end user's home.
Mr. Alexander, can I ask you to summarize the rest of your testimony, please?
I'm just
because
about
I
to
want
do
to make
that
sure
now.
That everybody has an opportunity to testify. Thank you.
It costs money to install the water meters at every residence, and that's already clear from the bill put together. It is that the landlords don't want submetering. So what are we going to do? Well, let's review the issues for just a moment. Water meters. Without water meters, no one has any idea of how much natural resource is being wasted. So what happens when the well goes dry? There isn't any more water in the well. Do you suppose some of the water conservation methods may have helped the situation? Saving our natural resources needs to be our number one priority. If it takes a few dollars to fix and help preserve it, we better be thinking twice about doing it before it's too late. The state of Oregon has a very aggressive conservation program. Then there's the safety issues. The water metering system tells the operator how bad the water system may be. By knowing you have high water loss, you may know your system is just waiting for a disaster to happen. When someone who is in bad health drinks a glass of contaminated water and dies from it, who do you suppose is going to be held responsible? Every weekend for the last 3 weeks, our pressure has dropped well below 20 pounds. Enforcement is necessary because you can't get people to call you back from the state or the county regarding these problems. So basically, overall, what I'm trying to say is that this is a very important bill. It's a very important issue, metering water and keeping control of water loss. Water is a very precious resource, and the state of Oregon has made it clear about our aquifers are in decline, and we have to do something to help take care of that. One of the things the House has done is they've introduced House Bill 2980, which gives rebates to people who install water savings devices. And if the state of Oregon is willing to go that far to give rebates on their taxes for that type of issue, I would say water metering is also a very important issue. If we're going to give money away to keep people to save water, we need to water meter the system and make sure that it's kept safe and accounted for.
Thank you for your testimony. You said that you live in a manufactured home park. How do you pay your water bill?
It's in our rent. Part of our rent at this time.
Thank you. Questions? Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And next I'm going to call Kat Smith, Cynthia Smith, and Barbara March, please. Welcome.
You're good.
Who would like to go first? Kat, do you want to go first?
Okay.
Can you please state your name for the record and then give
us
your
testimony. My name is Catherine Smith. I live in Heritage Village. This bill is very important to our family because our water bill is actually fairly high. Our mom lost her job in the fall, so there isn't much money. And my brother and I are not old enough to try and get a job to help. We're very careful with our money, and we try to conserve as much as possible. We don't have cable or cell phones. We try to take 5-minute showers. We don't water our lawn in the summer. We turn off the lights and unplug appliances like TV and the toaster when we are not using them. We don't go out as much, and we don't have after-school activities, and we don't have as good food as we used to because we can't really afford it anymore. The metering is important in a mobile home park like us. Since we own our homes, it's harder for us to move out because if we want to move or sell the house, we have to keep paying rent until it gets sold. There are also lots of different sizes of family in the park. There's a retired woman across the street that has grandkids, maybe come over twice a year, and she uses less water than, say, the person with 8 people in their house that lives down the street. We have 3 members in our household and our pets and our garden, and we know that a lot of people in our park are retired and can't make extra money to try and help with the extra expenses that are coming in from this divided water bill. So when the bill goes up, it's very hard for them, and it's not fair to make them pay more than they can afford. We can't control anybody else. Even if we use the least amount of water possible, the water bill will still be high, and we really can't control that. We understand that businesses need to make as much money as possible, but we think that the bill is written now is too hard on tenants. Metering our water is still helps our park owners more than it was previously, but it also is easier on the residents of the park. So, I think that everybody should be able to control the amount of water that they're using and therefore the amount of money they're spending. We know there aren't very many people in motor parks, so I am very grateful that you're hearing us today.
Thank you very much for your excellent testimony, Kat. And is that your brother back there smiling?
Yes. Right.
And we did get your written testimony. And is your mom here to testify, too? Would you like to add something? Thank you.
The main point, I'm sorry, do I need to say my name?
Please.
It's Cynthia Smith. The main point I want to make is the difference between sub-metering and per occupant. It doesn't apply in a park our size. If you've ever been to our park, we have 2 swimming pools and acres of greenway. All of our yards are different sizes. As Kat said, we keep a garden, but we know people that don't have any plants and don't use any extra water. So on a a per-person basis, that excludes the fact that we're watering all those greenways, filling the pools, and our case, we're watering our yard. I feel that a park the size of Heritage Village and the bigger parks that have such a lot of common area, the $100 a month extra for us represents about a 15% increase in our housing cost that didn't cost the park anything, and I feel that putting in meters is a reasonable investment for them to be able to take advantage of that extra money.
Thank you. And Cynthia, how long have you lived at Heritage Village?
4 years.
And how does your payment now compare to what it was before the water bill was taken?
When we first came in, it was $555, and now it's going to be up $665.
Thank you. Any other questions? Kat, what grade are you in?
I'm in sixth grade.
You're in sixth grade. Thank you. And Barbara March?
Thank you. My name is Barbara March, and I live in Heritage Village, too. And I agree with everything that they said. In fact, I've been there, raised three on my own, so I know what she's going through. But anyway, I was asked just to come here and give an example of a lot of the other people that live in the park. I have $400 left over after paying everything, and if my water bill goes up $100 a month, I'm not even going to have that, and that's not including food. And in the park, there are an awful lot of people in the same situation as I am, and I don't mind paying a water bill. I had a home in Wilsonville at one time, and I paid $35 a month for water for a three-bedroom home, stick home. And I think that's reasonable. But this, what they're doing to us is outrageous. It's highway robbery, and they should not be able to get away with it, whether it means metering or whatever. They just can't get away with it legally, I don't think. I don't think they should be able to.
Ms. March, how long have you lived at Heritage?
3 years.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you. Kat, do you get extra credit for testimony?
I don't think West Cleveland knows.
You're on spring break, right? I think I could tell your teachers.
Very nice.
Thank you for your testimony. John Brenneman and Phil Guerin, please.
Please. Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Oh, Troy's with you? Okay.
Troy Boss, too, if that's right.
I see him on the list.
I'm John Brennan.
Oh, underneath. Okay, sorry about that. Squeezed under there. Okay, if you'll state your name for the record, please.
John Brennan, I represent Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. We have about nearly 500 member parks around the state, as small as four spaces, as large as several hundred. With me to my left is Troy Boss, who is this year's president at MHCO, and he and his family constructed an award-winning park in Eugene, and I think he can speak to a little bit of the effect of the bill. And to my far left is Phil Quirin, who is MHCO's legal counsel. And I'll just turn it over here to Troy so he can talk about his park and the troubles he had putting it together on water and why he made the decisions he did.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Troy Brost. As John said, I own Songbrook, manufactured home community in Eugene. I'm also the president of MHCO, former legislative chairman for several sessions. I'm opposed to Senate Bill 929. However, I do support the physical submetering of water, providing that it is legal and equitable. As the 2005 legislative chairman for MHCO, I supported and participated in the Oregon Statewide Manufactured Housing Coalition that we're aware of, which drafted House Bill 2247, and it allowed landlords to, quote, unilaterally amend the rental agreement to convert a tenant's existing utility or service billing method. So a little history. Back in 1993, the time when I constructed my community, installation of individual water meters was our preference. That's exactly what we wanted to install. At that time, the Eugene Water and Electric Board, the utility water provider in Eugene, informed us that the waiting period for the installation for 140 home site meters was 1 to 1.5 years. course, E-Web could not serve our needs at that time. We therefore opted to install a 6-inch master meter system for our community. To date, the systems worked well. We chose to include water and sewer in our rent at the time of conception in 93. The downside, as you've heard some testimony, it is difficult to isolate leaks, and conservation is not a consideration at all, resulting in greater water usage and increased expense to my tenants as their rent increases annually based upon the water rate increase I receive from E-Web. This year resulted in a monthly increase of $1.91. Requiring landlords to install submeters, however, I believe is an enormous and unnecessary expense to all parties involved. In 1993, I paid in excess of $120,000 in water meter and SDC fees for the 1/6-inch master meter system. My 2008 average monthly water expense per site was approximately $18 per homeowner. And that's a commercial rate. If I'm required to break federal law and install 140 submeters, which I figured at approximately $750 per site, I estimate the one-year pass-through rent increase, and considering that I would be backing out the rent, the cost of the water in the rent, I estimated at approximately $45 per month. Plus, we got to remember that the homeowner is now going to be receiving an E-Web bill that's going to be charged for their individual water usage, and that is not going to be on my rate. That's a commercial rate. So such wisdom results in approximately 30-year payoff period for my tenants versus the current master meter system. And additionally, my tenants will no longer benefit, again, from my commercial rates. So here's a thought, kind of facetiously. If physical water submeters are important to the state, maybe the state should absorb the meter, the installation, and the liability costs of breaking federal law, which will be explained shortly. This effort would result in a triple win. There is good to it. The landlords are not required to break the federal law. The tenants are not financially penalized, and water is equitably distributed and conserved. So I ask you to support the frontline efforts of the statewide manufactured home industry landlord-tenant coalition. Please do not support Senate Bill 292, as it diminishes the ability of this coalition to run and requires landlords to break federal law and financially burdens my homeowners through cost pass-throughs. So thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. We'll hear all the testimony from the panel and then open it up to questions. Phil?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Philip Quirin. I'm an attorney in Portland, Oregon. I've been practicing since 1972, primarily real estate. And since about 1985, I believe, I've been representing the manufactured housing industry, and I am the current attorney and have been for probably at least 10 years, MHCO's legal counsel. And let me say that individually, personally, as well as our association, we understand a lot of these issues that have been expressed by the residents themselves. And I'm not sure that we really disagree that that submetering is a great idea. But let me tell you that this is going to be the lawyer's full-time employment act if you allow this bill to pass. Because clearly this bill is federally, the federal law preempts this state bill. I can, for those of you that are interested, I can give you the citation, 42 U.S.C. Section 30G, and it essentially says that no such law shall relieve any person of any requirement otherwise applicable under this act. So as well-intentioned as everybody is, that we should have submetering, and as much benefit as submetering, in fact, I think, brings to the community, it's a sort of thing where to force a park to intentionally violate the law raises all sorts of unintended consequences. And let me leave you with some without talking about any particular horror stories. But I have no idea if I were going to sell a home whether or not I'm obligated or not to tell the buyer of that home that, oh, by the way, our water system's in violation of the federal EPA, and we haven't been doing any water testing, but we're in violation because we've got a sub-metering system, and the EPA has said that we're subject to the Clean Water Act. So that's problem number one. Not to mention the cost itself of the monitoring that would be included in being subjected to that law. Last night I got on the internet and I printed off about five pages of fines ranging from $5 to $11 to $100,000 for violation of the Fair Water Act. I don't know where a fine would end up. And I'm not suggesting either that anybody's going to be fined or that, in fact, they have been fined. We know that within the state of Oregon that there's been several parks that have, in fact, submetered. And they have, at least my clients, they've done so as a knowing risk, but they made the decision because they felt that, from a cost standpoint, it was going to help them out substantially, and they were willing to take that risk. But as a practical matter, my concern is that creating a law that says you shall do something that clearly the EPA says we can't do creates what I think is a terrible precedent for all of the parks. And this is not to mention any of the costs, for example, that Troy's talking about. I don't even know, for example, if one could get insurance. Being in violation of federal law and you fill out an insurance application. Let's say that there is in fact some contamination upstream, so to speak, and it goes through the water meter and all of a sudden we're a water provider and we've got liability. The folks that are on the other end, the receiving end, are tenants. And if anybody's practiced landlord-tenant law, they know what habitability means and what essential services are, and they know the kind of liability that there's a lot of plaintiff's attorneys out there that would jump all over the landlord if, in fact, they were in violation of the EPA. So, as I said, there's a lot of unintentional consequences that come with this. And let me end by, I looked at a portion of John Van Landingham's statement, and he said, if the submetering issue is not fully resolved this session, the coalition is committed to working on it in the interim and has several strategies in mind. I worked closely with John, as did several of the other attorneys in our firm, on Myra Lynn, which had similar issues in regards to electricity. And we worked it out. We worked it out amicably, and I am confident that given time that the coalition, which I think has been a very productive and collaborative group, will be able to work this out without putting the industry itself in a position of high risk and, I think, continued liability, which I think can be resolved in another manner. So we would oppose 929.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a couple questions first. Mr. Brost, how many home sites are in your park in Songbrook?
Songbrook has 140 home sites.
140. Thank you. And when you said you paid, you have this $120,000 charge for the water meter and the SDC fees,
mm-hmm.
Was that an initial fee for setting up the entire water system?
That was the portion of the water meter system for the entire infrastructure. Yes. Initially paid in 1993.
Thank you.
I don't know what it would cost today.
Okay. Thank you. And then, Mr. Is it Guerin or Quarin?
Quarin.
I want to clarify some things just so that there's a clear record.
Sure.
Clarify some of the things that were said. You're saying, I believe you said this would be against the law and you would force park owners to do something that's against the law. It's my understanding that there's nothing in the federal law that says that a manufactured home park cannot submeter. Is that correct?
I would respectfully disagree. The law essentially is the federal law preempts a state law to the extent that the federal law itself is violated. If it says, for example, as we know from that EPA case, that clearly said if you have a water meter, then you are a water provider and subject to the Clean Water Act.
So it doesn't say that the park can't submeter. It says that there's a possibility that if the park submeters, the park will have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act.
The word possibility is not in there. And I don't mean to be argumentative, but if I am told that if I put a submeter in the ground, that makes me a water provider under the EPA, and that I then am a water provider and I have to have testing, then that's exactly what I have to do. And if I fail to do that, then I am in violation. And the law does not say that the state itself cannot have regulations affecting water meters. But in fact, as we know, the state, in order to accommodate the submetering law, amended the state law in order to allow it. If the EPA did that, we'd be home free. But right now, the way I look at it, if there's any liability at all, under a submetering program that exists today, if in fact that occurs and we're subject to the EPA, then if there's any violation of the EPA law, there's going to be there's either going to be fines, there'll be civil liability, and under the Oregon Landlord Tenant Act, I believe there would also be substantial liability.
But you said there are parks in Oregon now that have submeters for water.
Oh, absolutely. Right. Clients of mine.
And have any of them been fined?
No. I will represent to you that not only do I not know of any that have been fined, but clients of mine, large clients of mine, have in fact done submetering and saved thousands and thousands of dollars. And that's one of the reasons that they've in fact assumed the risk. Is because they weighed the advantages and disadvantages, and they decided that to save the $10,000 or $20,000 a month in savings from the submetering, in fact, was worth the risk. And as I say, you can be sure that they were well advised before they did that there was in fact a risk. So I guess what I'm saying is, in the long run, just because it hasn't happened doesn't mean it won't happen, and I don't want to see that happen to our industry unless and until we get some nod from the EPA that in fact it's permissible. And after just leaving a case, within the last couple of years, that said we can't do it, we are a water provider if we do it, it seems to me that the message is pretty clear that it's a blatant violation of the law to do it, and you're taking a risk to do it.
Okay, and I don't want to be argumentative either, but I just want to make sure that I understand that you're saying to us that it's against the law to require parks to do it, but you're saying your clients do it and they've never been fined for doing it.
That's exactly right. Okay. Right. It's an assumed risk.
Just want to clarify.
Okay. Yes, it's an assumed risk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Troy, in your testimony, you talk about what it would cost to reinstall meters in an existing structure. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is kind of a mathematical issue, because what you don't want to do is have somebody go in and install all of the meters, and then actually the net costs go up to the tenant.
Mm-hmm.
So you've used the number of $750 to go in and reinstall. So some of the testimony we've heard about people going and reinstalling meters in existing facilities, your math says it's actually 30 years for that to pay off. How did you come up with the $750 each, and how much would it actually cost to get a meter on
sure.
a single unit?
Sure. I can tell you that I have not got bids. I have not received bids because I'm not one of his clients, Phil's clients, that wants to take the risk.
Gotcha.
So I've done personal research and formulating averages of what a plumber is going to cost, what a meter is going to cost, what a laborer is going to cost, and formulating into my community. Some may testify, I don't have a typical community. I think this number is accurate for me, I believe. It could be less, it could be more for others. For me, this number is fairly fair, the $750, in my best formulation of a cost. Reason being, I would not be installing meters underneath the house. My legal documents stipulate that my owners, my homeowners, I call them tenants, from the curb to their house, they own all those utilities. So my meters would be installed at the curb, and which provides some benefit in reading. I don't have to enter their property. But it also provides some disadvantages to me financially, because a number of my shutoff valves at the curb are in driveways or in concrete areas. So it's considerable labor to get to that expense.
Thank you very much.
Okay, any other questions for this panel? Senator Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. And I don't know if anybody in this panel would know the answer, but I sat on a city council, and I'm with this bill, I'd be extremely concerned about systems development charges and the way that each city has different codes. Now, I know the city that I lived in, it was so much per meter and so much for the size of the pipe that was being metered. So have you run into any problems with the huge variation within systems development charges and the codes from different cities?
Madam Chair, Senator, I know over the years that's been a big consideration, that the system development charges in many communities have risen to the point where you haven't seen any new park construction for that and other reasons, but it became a big factor. I assume maybe that Troy was going to address what system development charge might be factored back in where he lives, but I would guess there would probably be a pretty good sized one.
Madam Chair, I just like to make some of these system development charges can run in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for a major park, and so we're not talking just small amounts of money.
That would be a question, I think, to get answered, is whether adding a sub-meter to an existing system would require payment of a system development charge. Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. And we have some other witnesses, and as they come forward, I'm going to ask Jill, and I'm sorry I can't read the last name, the people from the Eugene Water and Electric Board, please. And as they're coming forward, I just want to put on the record to the committee, I did look into a submetering project that was done in Santa Clara Valley, California, with several manufactured home parks. In the report was done in 2008. The costs that they had, they did a little more than 1,100 submeters in several parks, was a total of $172 per submeter, and their results, they did five parks. There was 99 submeters in one park, 433 in another, 361 in another, 108 and 186, so about 1,100. The results that they had was an average of a 22.5% reduction in water use. They anticipated 15%, and the result of savings was exceeded their expectations, was 22.5%, and that was in Santa Clara County, California. Do I have the people from Eugene Water and Electric Board? Thank you. Was it just you?
Yeah, Jill Huyendo from Eugene Water and Electric Board. Thank you,
welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I have a cough, and you have my written testimony. So if I start coughing, I'm exiting, and you can just...
Thank you. We have water here, which is
lovely. Thank you. I just want
to... If you'll state your name, please, for the record.
Jill Hoyenga, Eugene Water and Electric Board. I am the Water Management Services Supervisor. I've worked in water conservation and cross-connection control for the last 13 years, mostly as a field representative for our eWeb. And thank you. And I'm now supervisor for the last couple years. So most of my testimony is from my experience working with customers. eWeb is in support of this legislation because it will help water utilities be more effective in compliance with the OAR, and the numbers are there, but I'm going to commonly call it Division 86, as we do in the industry. Division 86 is a key factor in maintaining access to water supply for the citizens we serve, in that we need to prove that we have conserved water in order to deserve access to future water supply. So a component of compliance Division 86 is for water utilities to offer technical assistance for water conservation purposes and to have provable results. I and my staff have served several mobile home parks, and The challenge is that the residents are very motivated and have all kinds of opportunities, and we literally will go through and give them efficient fixture retrofits, etc. And then we find through data logging that the real culprit is the distribution system of the master meter distribution system. So, and then the owner is not motivated because they're just splitting the water bill and being able to pass through those costs as operations costs rather than investing in the capital costs. So I'm going to just quickly, there's three different examples in the fourth paragraph, and I want to just zoom in on the second example that I gave there. I don't have any manufactured home park examples because we haven't convinced them, even though we have loans for no interest loans for repair of leaks in the distribution system, they simply aren't interested. So these examples are from apartment houses, and this master meter facility in the second example had a 600,000 gallon a month leak, and they had had that since the service was turned on. It was a glue joint that popped in their service line, and so since day one they had close to 600,000 gallons a month of water no one was actually using, and they were charging their customers for that because they simply didn't know. It wasn't ill-intentioned. It wasn't really anybody doing anything bad. They just didn't know until we gave them data logging services, and that went on for about 10 years until before we came on site. I just want to do a little math for you. That was 13 gallons a minute. That's about 7 million gallons a year. And that's at the cost of water back then was right around $7,000 a year. And it cost less than $3,000 to fix that service line leak. Now, I understand that it's not always easy to find a leak. It's not always a simple matter to fix a leak. And it often is, in the case of distribution system, thousands of dollars. However, to be able to submeter and discover the difference between what's happening at the master meter and what's happening at the tenant level is very important. As my colleague from Boring talked about, that's what we're, as water utilities, required to do. And we have some recommendations in order to keep our distribution systems as tight as possible for conservation purposes and also for cross-connection control purposes, as he pointed out.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask if there's any questions now because we still have two more people to testify.
Fine.
I don't want to lose
Thank
all
you.
My committee members. So are there any questions? Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, just really quickly, do you know anything about this issue of whether the federal law would somehow prevent these park owners from being able to convert to submetering?
I have not consulted legal counsel, and so on the record, I would not want to say anything.
Okay.
Thank you.
Charlie Graff, please, and then after that will be our final witness, will be John Van Landingham.
Mr. Thoreau was signed up too, Chair.
Oh. Okay, I didn't see him, but come on up. If he wants to come up, that's fine. I only had your name on here.
Okay, I'll start again. My name is Steve Thoreau with CalAmp Properties, and I'd like to read a brief statement and follow up with some additional comments, if that's all right.
And we have 17 minutes.
I'll go quickly. I'm here to testify against SB 929. While CalAmp supports submetering on a theoretical level, the realistic implementation of submetering on a large-scale level has practical implications that must first be resolved. One of the most perplexing issues is the EPA ruling that has many onerous and indeed burdensome regulations for manufactured dwelling communities that install submeters. You've heard some of that testimony today. Suffice it to say that it seems unfair and imprudent that a law should be implemented that could entail significant monetary penalties by a federal agency for owners who comply with the state mandate. Another difficult issue is the expense involved installing submeters. While CalAmp supports the idea of submetering, we are concerned about the cost involved with implementing the program on a large scale. However, we have considered the notion at length and believe that the goal is attainable by consensus with all interested parties by exploring varied finance avenues, such as low-cost interest loans to residents that will reimburse owners for the meter installations, or government subsidies, including but not limited to tax incentives for property owners. CalM desires to be a responsible and prudent business owner, and we work hard every day to provide crime-free, drug-free communities, and that's a difficult task in places like Heritage Village, which you've heard a lot of testimony about today. We'll work with any parties, including the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, to develop a satisfactory, long-term solution that benefits all concerned groups. And my follow-up statements are, I just want to bring to your attention, because you've heard a lot of testimony today about Heritage Village in particular, and about the escalating costs and the cost of water and sewer. And I have with me here several documents. The first one is the water bill. First of all, probably a lot of you don't know, is that the Clean Water Services in Tualatin and Water Valley District increased water and sewer expenses 8%. And we cannot get in front of a body and say, that's a ridiculous increase, you know, we need some relief on that. They just do it. And they, you know, that we have to pay the bill. Okay, so that's point A. Point B is, we believe, and I know this for, I feel this is a fact, and some people won't agree with this, but I held many, many meetings when I did the rollouts of the water and sewer program. And in many communities, many of them senior, many of them family communities, I had several people stand up in these meetings and tell me, and some of them were seniors, tell me, thank you for doing this because my neighbor lets her children come over every weekend from their house, three neighborhoods over, and wash their RVs and wash their boats and do a lot of different things with the water. So when the water was free, people didn't pay attention to the usage. Now what I have here, again, is the bill from the Tualatin Valley Water District and Clean Water Services, which, by the way, Clean Water Services is very expensive for those of you who know about Clean Water Services. And that bill, in January of 2008, which was, and we implemented our changes 4 months later, the bill for water was $16,525. And the occupancy that day was the same as the occupancy is for this bill. And this bill, a year later, after what I believe has been conservation, the water bill is $11,146, a savings of $5,379. Now, that's substantial, and I think that will continue to go down. But it's an interesting point that even though the water bill went down, when you look at the sewer cost, which is the monster of this bill, which we have no control over, because when Tualatin Valley, when Clean Water Services builds a new processing plant or does something, they don't have any revenue. They have to get it from homeowners and from property owners. So in the same period where our water bill went down by $5,000, the actual sewer bill stayed about the same. In other words, in 2008, it was $9,643.30, and this year it was $9,425.50. So it went down $200. So why did the water bill go down $5,000 and the clean water bill only go down $200? I'll tell you, that's because the costs keep going up, and we can't control what Clean Water Services does. And a lot of that, and some of that is runoff, and people talk about water usage and all of that. One of the things you have to keep in mind is part of our bill is water runoff. Yes, if you live in a single-family home, you have water runoff. That's limited. But when you have water runoff from 450 homes, okay, all going into the same thing, we get billed for that. Okay, so that those there's many components that make up the bill, and it's unfair to say that, you know, that there's just it's a very simple thing, because it's not a very simple thing. Mm-hmm. And just for reference notes, too, when we rolled out this program 2 years ago, we gave people 2 years' notice that we were going to do the water and sewer pass-through, and for those 2 years, we did not increase rent. There were absolutely no rent increases for those 2 years. Okay? And we predicted, based on the bill, which was very large at that time, we predicted that the bill, based on the analysis, was going to be about $95 a month. Well, the bill that's going out this month is actually $20 less than that estimation, which is a good thing. Okay, the water component of that is actually only $24.68, and the sewer component of that is $51.68. So this is a bit off the mark. I realize testifying about the submeters, but I just wanted everyone to be clear that there are a lot of things, for lack of a better word, that go in to when we talk about passing water through and passing sewer through and the expenses that are involved with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Greff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Greff. I'm an attorney in Lake Oswego, and I'll spare you the details of my background. I provided those to you earlier with regard to 772.
And if you can please summarize. I know
we're
running
short
out of time.
I will, Judge.
We do have your written testimony, sir.
I would testify here, again, on behalf of the Oregon Park Owners Alliance, strenuously against this bill, Senate Bill 929. And as you've heard before, there are legitimate concerns that your constituents have regarding billing and the fairness of billing and whether or not the pro rata method that is used, for example, at Heritage is fair. But with all due respect, there are some real problems with a mandate that park owners switch or convert to submeters, which I think need to be more carefully reviewed before a bill can be considered and passed. One of which is the EPA decision. And my understanding, without paraphrasing Phil Quarin too much, I agree with his testimony, but essentially parks which have submetered utilities are indeed viewed as utility districts and should be regulated as such under the Safe Water Drinking Act. If passed, this bill would mandate that every park in Oregon become a utility district against its will, along with regulatory obligations, insurance requirements, and a myriad of other regulations that go along with that. It would mandate that park owners incur significant risk of violating federal law. It's simply untenable and unlawful. Now, the current method used by most park owners, at least on month-to-month tenancies, is to include the utilities as part of the base rent. SB 929 would outlaw that. It would say you can no longer do that. And to outlaw a method that's been in existence since parks have been in existence makes no sense for many reasons. First of all, smaller parks especially are having a hard time. They have high occupancy rates. The mom-and-pop, so to speak, park is going to have to spend the money up front to purchase and install water meters. They're going to have to pay related STC costs. The current state of the law, which is not modified, by the way, by either this bill or 772, is that there is then a rent reduction for 6 months after the effective date of the submeters, and there's a limitation on how quickly the parks can recover that capital improvement cost. Many small parks are going to simply go out of business, thus increasing homelessness and increasing, or I should say reducing, the availability of affordable housing. I also do not believe you can impose a requirement that big parks or wealthy park owners go along with submetering or be required to submeter, and those who are not big or wealthy do not. I think that would flagrantly violate equal protection and substantive due process. It's an irrational distinction. Another reason why I'm opposed and my group is opposed to this bill is because it is one that it was not brought to the attention of or negotiated within the coalition. We've heard about the coalition. It's been around since, I think, the late 70s. With one possible exception, I believe every single piece of landlord-tenant legislation has been negotiated through the coalition, and this bill has not. There is no give and take. There is no back and forth on this bill. In fact, many of the concerns that were voiced to the coalition about submetering, we've addressed in 772. We worked hard. Park owners gave up rights that they otherwise have now in order to get other rights, for example, in the temporary occupancy piece of that bill, and thus agreed to changes in the submetering statute. But now, with this bill, it almost defeats the very purpose of that negotiation. So I would submit, and this dovetails with some of the prior testimony that you've heard, that we take a closer look at this bill during the off-season, so to speak, and revisit it the next legislative session. There are too many booby traps, too many problems for park owners, and unfortunately many problems for park owners often trickle down to the tenants, and I think I've touched on some of those in terms of increased cost and lack of affordable housing. So I'd ask that you issue a do not pass recommendation on this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? I would still like to have time to get John. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
John?
Thank you.
Kind to meet you.
You're talking about this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. I want to try to respond to some of the points that have been made earlier. And so I'll do this pretty quickly and sort of bam, bam, bam. One, Troy Boyce mentioned the concern that his cheaper commercial rate would be lost if we submeter. That's exactly the problem that HB 2613 is intended to fix. So if 2613 passes, we won't. That would be a disincentive to submetering, but hopefully we'll be able to avoid that. Secondly, the legislation that we passed in 2005 regarding submetering explicitly provides at 90.537 sub 6 that a city may not charge an SDC for installing submeters. Third, I think that Charlie Greff helped to clarify the distinction between the chair and Phil Quarin over the EPA. I share, I think, that view, which is that the EPA, the Fair Clean Water Act, doesn't prevent submetering, but it would say that a park that does submeter is treated as a regulated utility. That's a complicated issue and a serious issue. And we've struggled. I know the industry has struggled at the federal level trying to get the EPA to reverse itself. It does not make that decision for apartments. Apartment landlords can submeter water without being a regulated utility. But I believe that the coalition could work on that issue in the interim. I note that the Dash 1 amendments that the chair mentioned at the beginning, or maybe Lori mentioned in the beginning, would have a 2012 date for the requirement, and that would give the coalition 2 years to work on that. I think we have some other strategies, but one of those is to educate landlords about what it would mean to be a regulated utility in this context. They are, after all, passing through water that they are buying from a utility. So the water's already tested. What would that mean? What would the Oregon require of a landlord to do that? We've started meeting with the PUC. We already met with some people in PUC to try to understand those issues. Couple of other quick points. The Landlord Tenant Act does already require park landlords to maintain their parks, including their water systems. So when Kathy Cruz mentions the M&Ms, there is a maintenance requirement. It's in 90.730. Sub 3, sub C is specifically water systems. The coalition negotiated and wrote that requirement. Over, I would note, the strenuous objections of some landlords. So the park does have to maintain the water system. Proving it is another matter and may well be very difficult and may well require lawyers. That brings me to the worst thing I have to say to you, which is that I don't believe that submetering will solve the problems the tenants feel they have in Heritage Village. Submetering would show water consumption on the space. Landlords are allowed to charge for water consumption in common areas as well as on the space. We can only submeter the space. So we would know with submetering how much water Pat Schwach, for example, uses on her space, or Peter Ferris uses on his space. But we would not know from the submeter how much water is lost from leaky pipes in the common area. And probably the pipe system is within that common area. It would help us narrow down where the leak is. And I think you had testimony from the EWEB person saying that would be a benefit of submetering. You would know where the leak is closer. So that might actually help to prove that the landlord has to maintain the system. But submetering by itself doesn't solve the problem. I think that demonstrates how complex it is. It's something that I am hopeful that we can work on in the coalition in the interim. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? John, do you know who in the state of Oregon enforces the Clean Drinking Water, Safe Drinking Water Act?
Madam Chair, I think it is state DEQ. But there is somebody at PUC. I can't remember her last name, a woman named Kathy, who met with the coalition and was very knowledgeable about it. And, in fact, MHCO has recruited her to be a speaker at one of their training programs to try to encourage landlords to do submetering. And I have the name that I think somebody gave me from DEQ that I haven't followed up with.
And does DHS, to your knowledge, have anything to do with
I'm sure I don't know.
Safe Drinking Water Act.
You've done a lot of research yourself, and you probably know more than I do.
Do you know if any of the parks in Oregon that currently submeter have been accused of violating federal law?
Madam Chair, no, I don't.
Thank you. Do you have a question? Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on Senate Bill 929? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 929 and adjourn our meeting for today. Thank you.